Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast, Immigration and Aggravated Felony Edition. I'm your host, Bridget Flaherty. On May 30th, 2017, the Supreme Court decided Esquivel-Quintana v. Sessions. In 2009, Juan Esquivel-Quintana, who was then 21, pleaded no contest to a California statutory rape offense after engaging in consensual sex with a 17-year-old. California criminalizes unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor who is more than 3 years younger than the perpetrator, and for this purpose considers anyone under the age of 18 to be a minor. The Department of Homeland Security then initiated removal proceedings against Esquivel-Quintana under the Immigration and Nationality Act, INA, which allows for the removal of any alien convicted of aggravated felony, including sexual abuse of a minor, though it does not define that phrase. The Board of Immigration Appeals, BIA, denied Esquivel-Quintana's appeal, concluding that the age difference between Esquivel-Quintana and the minor was sufficiently meaningful for their sexual encounter to qualify as abuse of a minor. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, deferring to the BIA's interpretation, denied Esquivel-Quintana's petition for further review. The question before the Supreme Court was whether a conviction under a state statute criminalizing consensual sexual intercourse between a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old qualifies as sexual abuse of a minor under the INA. By a vote of 8-0, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Sixth Circuit. In an opinion by Justice Thomas, the court held that in the context of statutory rape, offenses that criminalize sexual intercourse based solely on the ages of the participants, generic federal definition of sexual abuse of a minor requires the age of the victim to be less than 16. Because the California statute of conviction did not fall categorically within that generic federal definition, Esquivel-Quintana's conviction was not an aggravated felony under the INA. All other members joined in Justice Thomas's opinion, except Justice Gorsuch, who took no part in the consideration or decision of this case. And now, to discuss the case, we have Vikrant Reddy, Senior Research Fellow at the Charles Koch Institute.
Instead of talking a lot about what the Supreme Court did in this case, I'm actually going to spend a little bit more time talking about what the court did not do, because for the people who are really interested in matters of criminal law and even actually administrative law, the interesting story in Esquivel-Quintana is actually what didn't happen. But I'm going to start with the facts, and those are pretty straightforward. Under the Immigration and National Security Act, that's 8 U.S.C. section 1227, an alien can be deported from the United States upon, quote, conviction of an aggravated felony. Now, our law provides, or federal law provides, a list of things that can constitute an aggravated felony, and one of those things is sexual abuse of a minor. Now, the federal law does not specifically define sexual abuse of a minor, and that makes things a little bit complicated because minor, an age of consent, is different depending on what state you're in. I come from the state of Texas, and in my state, the age of consent is 17. Justice Gorsuch, who actually did not take part in this case, comes from the state of Colorado. There, the age of consent is 15. Barack Obama comes from Hawaii. The age of consent there is 14. Things get really, really different. There is a vast array of different ages that the age of consent is set at, depending on what state the conduct takes place in. Mr. Esquivel-Quintana's conduct took place in California. He is a lawful permanent resident of California. He's originally and still is a Mexican citizen. In California, the age of consent is 18 years. When he was 20 years old, he had consensual sex with his 16-year-old girlfriend. This all happened in 2009. So in California, because the girl was 16 and he was 20, and California's age of consent is 18, that behavior constituted statutory rape. It is unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor who is more than 3 years younger than the perpetrator. That's California law. And he pleaded no contest to this offense under California law. So now it went to the Department of Homeland Security, which under the federal act that I cited before was in a position to deport him back to Mexico because he had committed sexual abuse of a minor, and that was, under the federal statute, an aggravated felony. The Board of Immigration Appeals agreed with the decision of the Department of Homeland Security, and the case then went to the Sixth Circuit, which denied his appeal. But there was a dissent from the denial, and that dissent came from Judge Jeff Sutton. And I want to come back to Judge Sutton's dissent momentarily, because it's really at the heart of what is the intellectual issue here. The decision from the Board of Immigration Appeals is what really kind of made this case interesting to a lot of people. The lower courts essentially sided with the board, saying, well, let's take a look at the problem here. We've got a statute that has some ambiguous and ill-defined language. You could reasonably interpret the language either way. In cases like that, what you do is you defer to the judgment of the agency or the board in question, because that's what we do under Chevron. This is the 1984 case which holds that you have to defer to agency and board interpretations statutes. Now, Chevron may or may not be a wise precedent. There's a very vigorous national conversation happening about this right now. I think it's pretty obvious that it poses a difficult problem when you are looking at the criminal law sphere, because what you have with the criminal law is courts deferring on interpretations of language in statutes that affect whether or not people can be incarcerated, whether or not they can be deported, like the man in this case, really whether or not they can even be executed. It's the most extraordinary power, domestic power, that government has, the power to enforce criminal law. And the idea that it would be delegated out under Chevron to administrative agencies is extremely problematic. It's troubling enough in the civil sphere, but in the criminal sphere, it can be very, very dangerous, because the people involved in making the decisions are ultimately unelected bureaucrats. And I don't mean bureaucrat in the kind of dismissive or derogatory way that it can be said sometimes. I just literally mean that these are people who do not have direct accountability via elections. And it's very dangerous to delegate such an extraordinary power to people who don't have that kind of accountability. So this was the question that came before the court, and the government made the argument that, well, Chevron is Chevron, and you have an ambiguous statute here. You're going to have to defer to the board's interpretation. Mr. Esquivel-Quintana made a different argument. He said, no, I mean, this is a criminal statute. What you would do in a case like this where you've got ambiguous language that could go either way is you would just apply the rule of lenity. And the rule of lenity is an interpretive doctrine that says whenever you've got ambiguous language that could go either direction reasonably, you defer in favor of the defendant. This is really important protection for individual rights. The idea is that it forces from the get-go legislatures to be very precise and very careful with their drafting of criminal statute. And Mr. Esquivel-Quintana made the rule of lenity argument. The government made the Chevron argument. So the court decided to do either, actually. They ducked the question. The decision was 8-0, and the court sort of went a different direction. They said, you know, we need a generic definition under federal law of what the age of consent is, because we've got all of these different ages of consent in different states, and it can't possibly be the case that the federal law is just situation specific and depends on what state the conduct took place in. Was it in Georgia? Was it in California? Was it in Maryland? Was it in Colorado or Hawaii or Texas? It can't work that way. We've got to figure out what the generic definition is. The court turned to a dictionary. They went to the Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage at the time that the relevant immigration statute was passed, and they found that it defined age of consent as 16. The government had a problem with that. In their brief, they went a different direction. They went to Black's Law Dictionary, and they said, well, in this dictionary, the generic age of consent would be 18. The court didn't like that argument because the court saw it. The government was using age of majority rather than age of consent. Age of majority is a little bit different. That's, you know, the age that you are able to enter into contracts and things of that sort. Age of consent is different. And in fact, they even argue that in Black's Law Dictionary, in addition to the Dictionary of Modern Legal Usage, the age of consent is more appropriately set at 16. That is the generic age of consent for the purposes of federal law. So because they were able to decide the question that way, they didn't really need to get into this question, Chevron deference versus rule of lenity. And deciding the case that way was a pretty obvious call to all the members of the court. The decision went 8-0. Justice Gorsuch did not take part in the case. And so the case was decided relatively easily, but in a sense it kind of ended with a whimper rather than with a bang for people who have criminal practices and people who are interested in administrative law questions, because a lot of folks were really hoping that an answer would come forward on this question of the scope of Chevron deference. And it's become a very important part of the overall critique of Chevron that has been made by a number of very prominent people. A lot of the problems that we have with Chevron and Chevron deference and the way that it has empowered in a lot of counterproductive ways the administrative state here in the United States. So I said I would go back to Judge Sutton and his comments in his original dissent in this case, because I think they're really important and they're at the heart of what is intellectually interesting here. I'm going to read them to all of you, this one paragraph that stands out to me. He wrote that Chevron has no role to play in construing criminal statute. In 227 years and counting, the federal courts have never presumed that when an ambiguity arises in a criminal statute, the congressional silence signals that Congress wants an executive branch agency to fill the gap. For all the theories of Chevron that have filled the U.S. reports, that filled the Federal Reporter, to say nothing of the law journals, the idea that Chevron is a tool for construing criminal statutes has yet to make an appearance. That's because criminal statutes are for courts, not for the government to construe. So that's where we're left here. Esquivel-Quintana was an interesting case, but at the end of the day, it didn't get to the question that most interest people who are scholars of Chevron administrative law and of criminal law. And we're just kind of left waiting to see if a case like that will come up anytime soon. I think that eventually the court is going to have to take on this question of to what extent Chevron applies to interpretation of criminal statutes. I don't know where that case is. Maybe there's something percolating in the lower courts as we speak, but that's where we are.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.